When an effort is made to address a problem that's seen and the effort falls short, that can harm whoever the effort was designed to help. And when that falling short is allowed to continue, those who were promised to receive help and support, they wind up being endangered both in short as well as long-term ways. This is what comes to, I hope, a greater awareness through the book by my next guest, who makes this observation about the family court system and backs up those observations with not just history, but solutions. You'll find this in her book, The End of Family Court, How Abolishing the Court Brings Justice to Children and Families. She is the Edward Ross Arano Clinical Professor of Law Emerita at Columbia Law School. Jane Spinnick, thank you so much for being here today, Jane.
Thank you, Chris. I'm happy to be here.
And learn more about the educational opportunities at the Columbia Law School. It is law.columbia.edu. Let's start with a fast history lesson about the family court system, Jane. What was the intent, what was the catalyst, and what was eventually formed all the way back in the early 1900s?
Well, the system, the actual court was started in 1899 as a juvenile court. And the idea behind this court was that a benevolent judge and a helper, maybe a probation officer or a social worker, would fix the children and families who found themselves in that court. So the families were predominantly immigrant families who were flooding into the cities at the time, and there was great concern about whether these families, who were very poor, could take care of their children. And there was a lot of fear that these children were getting into a lot of trouble and that there needed to be this, quote, social court to address whatever trouble they were getting into. At the time, there was no real distinction among the jurisdiction that this court had. So it covered delinquency, it covered dependency, it covered children getting into trouble but not really breaking the law. And the idea was that the judge would solve the problem, first of these children and later of their families.
Which all sounds like a terrific, a wonderful, positive idea, but as your history lesson in your book teaches, they showed up with not exactly a full toolbox, did they?
No, not at all. I mean, one of the difficulties is that this court did not have the services, the supports that these families needed. Then, like now, most of the families, an overwhelming number of the families who find themselves in court are poor. They're impoverished families. Increasingly, over the course of the century, they were disproportionately children and families of color. So as the immigrant families moved out of the big cities and off into the suburbs, many minority people moved into the inner cities, particularly the Black community, outside of cities, the Native American community, and that's who find themselves disproportionately in that court today, along with impoverished people of any color.
We always think of our court system, our criminal court system, as a system where equal rights, I mean, the balance scales and the blindfolded lady of justice as the symbol of fairness, equality, and justice. Was that true with the family court, or as you say in those early days too, because of a lack, and continuing through the history, the lack of proper remedies, to me seems like it was criminalizing kids who committed non-violent actions.
Well, it criminalized children in ways that was really quite astounding. I mean, young people who might have gotten into trouble, didn't go to school or ran away, were considered delinquent for much of the 20th century, along with young people who might actually be committing crimes. The idea of the court was that the court would deal with these young people benevolently, but they didn't. In fact, much of the same kinds of punishment that they would have received as adults, they received as children. Children were, instead of jail, they were in detention facilities. Instead of prison, they were in reform schools. And when the Supreme Court finally looked hard at this system in the 1960s, Justice Fortas called it a kangaroo court. It didn't have any of the due process that an adult criminal court should have. And he basically said it's the worst of both worlds. There's no due process, but these young people aren't actually given the support that they need.
So with Jane Spinnick, Edward Ross Arano, Clinical Professor of Law Emerita, Columbia Law School, law.columbia.edu, is her website, The End of Family Court, her book, How Abolishing the Court Brings Justice to Children and Families. We are going to get into the second part of that title in this segment, because it's the obvious question for someone listening who is hopefully going to read your book, especially if they are involved or about to become involved in the family court process, is why has this been allowed to exist so long? Because as I'm reading The End of Family Court, I'm thinking, well, there's always been this question about why youths become career criminals, why repetitive actions of crime continue. And it's obvious now that there was no way to remedy what was a horrible situation for that youth for the actions they took, and they grew up to be bigger criminals. So why has this been allowed to exist? Has it just become a cottage industry where it's feeding itself and then just became bloated?
Well, it's certainly feeding itself. It's doing that both in the delinquency area that you and I have been talking about, but also in what I now call family regulation or family policing, and most people know as child protection or child welfare. In those kinds of cases, millions of children are reported as being at risk of neglect or abuse every year. And what we know now is that most of those children, let's say 75 to 80%, those families are not actually neglecting their children. What they're doing is they're living in poverty, and they also have living in communities that are underserviced and unequal, and that poverty and that inequality gets translated too often as they must be neglecting their children. The families that need to be in a court, not this court in my mind, but in a court, are those who are really harming their children. Severe abuse, sexual abuse, terrible neglect like starvation. Of course, we need to intervene for that kind of a case. But that kind of a case takes up maybe 20%, maybe a little more, depending on the year, of the caseloads. And instead, we have created this mandatory reporting system in which people, the schools and doctors and anybody almost who interacts with children, sees something they may be concerned about. Child seems hungry, maybe they're a little dirty, and they immediately report this. The result is that instead of supporting families, we are reporting them. And of those millions of children who end up being reported, so there's a whole system that we're feeding to report, and then those who make it to family court, which is about a half a million families a year, end up being very enmeshed in a system that, as you put it, feeds itself, because there's an entire bureaucracy set up to keep this system going. And part of what I was so concerned about was that by pulling whatever money there is into the court system, you're pulling it out of voluntary or even government resources in the community that could actually help those families rather than taking them into a court that does not help them and often is very destructive of those families.
Which is one of the key parts of your book, because when people see the title, The End of Family Court, this, you're not advocating a slamming of the door and starting from ground zero and building something new. You're talking more of a transitional idea of taking from what is to something better that should be.
Yes, but I think it's a two-step process. That is, this system itself can be shrunk significantly. So, for example, our current definition of neglect and abuse is it's both vague and wide. And it could be narrowed and clearer so that someone who comes in contact with a child, like a teacher, knows, oh, well, this child seems hungry. I need to see who do I help find the child and their family the resources, not, oh, I have to call the court because this must be neglect. So that's an aspect. Similarly, in the juvenile legal system, we bring too many children into court who don't belong there. So one of the ways to change that is to use the international standard of juvenile responsibility, which is age 14. So young people who get in trouble or break the law who are under 14 need services outside of court. They don't really have the capacity to go through a court system that is going to adjudicate them with the same tools that are used by adults. And as I said, the international standard and the standard in many developed countries is 14. Below 14, we're going to figure out how to help you. If you're over 14, then we'll consider whether you have criminal responsibility. So those are the kinds of shrinking that need to be done so that when you get to what's left in this court, there's really an understanding that we don't have to have a separate court that has this legacy that it believes it can do good. Because the civil court doesn't have that legacy, nor does the criminal court. They are trying to adjudicate issues and be fair, not trying to somehow decide on their own what they think would be best. And so when you shrink that jurisdiction and you use that money in communities, then you can really ask yourself, do we need what's left? Or can it be parsed out to the criminal system and the civil system in ways that are much more likely to provide due process for those families and children who are left?
We so often, when we see a situation, ask, why has that been allowed to continue? Well, Jane, with her book, The End of Family Court, How Abolishing the Court Brings Justice to Children and Families, takes you through that timeline of how something really wrong was allowed to fester and grow the absolutely wrong direction to grow what it became today. And she offers, as you heard, and she gets into greater detail in the book, The End of Family Court, she details exactly what a proper, fair, just solution that would result in positive moves forward for all concerned should be, and more importantly, can be. Again, the book is The End of Family Court, How Abolishing the Court Brings Justice to Children and Families. She is the Edward Ross Arano Clinical Professor of Law Emerita at Columbia Law School, their website, law.columbia.edu. Jane Spinnick, you present the problem, and more importantly, you also present the ways to solutions that will be a benefit to those who have troubles now but have potential, should, as long as they get the guidance and the direction they need. Thanks for doing that. Thanks for writing the book and sharing these ideas, and thank you for being here today.
Well, thank you, Chris. Thanks for a really interesting conversation.